For our listening audience of blind and print impaired folks, the North Carolina Reading Service presents The Indie Week. John Federson reading to you the Independent Weekly Journal. And today's issue is dated August the 22nd of 2024. Welcome, everybody. It's a lot of articles here from this and a couple of held over from past issues. And John Federson better get to it. So here we go. First, from the city of Raleigh, the city council has advanced a plan to relocate the Red Hat Amphitheater and close South Street. That's a major east-west thoroughfare downtown. At the September 17th public hearing for the proposed relocation of Red Hat, the City Council seems to be looking for ways to make the plan work, despite lingering concerns about public engagement, neighboring communities, and, of course, traffic. The Council agreed on Monday to move forward with closing South Street between South McDowell and South Dawson and purchasing an adjacent two-tenths of an acre parcel to make room to relocate that amphitheater, given that the convention center's expansion could soon overtake its current location on South McDowell. But nothing is set in stone until the expected vote. Moving the amphitheater over one block would keep it downtown, within walking distance of local restaurants and businesses. That idea has near universal support. But closing off South Street is less popular. It would disrupt connectivity from downtown to Dix Park and Boylan Heights and Heritage Park neighborhoods. At its August 20th meeting, the council heard impassioned public comments from downtown business owners who repeated the message they have voiced for weeks. Losing the amphitheater would be disastrous for downtown. Pam Blondin, the owner of Deco Raleigh, a gift shop on Salisbury, said, "I can say to you categorically that were it not for venues like Red Hat, I would not still be in business. Considering the foot traffic Red Hat brings downtown, boosting public safety and the local economy." Most community members who spoke agreed that closing off part of South Street to keep it downtown wasn't necessary, if imperfect, solution. But some dissenters argued that cutting off South Street would disrupt traffic flow through downtown, harming nearby businesses and neighborhoods. But much of the debate surrounding South Street's proposed closure stemmed from a perceived lack of transparency from city staff about the planning process for that relocation. Some residents expressed confusion about why South Street should close instead of Lenore on the other side of the block. In an effort to ease these concerns, Carrie Painter, the city's executive director of the Raleigh Convention and Performing Arts Complex, gave a detailed presentation to the council on Tuesday about the different options that city staff had considered for the new location and why they ultimately recommended the council authorize closing South Street. Painter explained the city has a $40 million budget for this project and a set of specifications for the new amphitheater. It needs to fit 6,000 people, about the same as currently, in order to continue attracting the same caliber of performers. It must also be spacious enough to accommodate food and beverage stations, restrooms, artist dressing rooms, and safe egress. The city evaluated a plan to close Lenore Street to make room for that amphitheater and another that didn't close either Lenore or South, but staff determined neither option would be feasible for $40 million, nor would either create enough space for enough seats, stations, and back-of-house amenities for artists. Painter said the only way to meet all these needs is to close South Street and purchase a small triangle of land on the other side of it. The added square footage from the street closure, plus that 2.2-acre parcel, would be enough to expand the amphitheater's footprint, she said, adding that the NC Department of Transportation currently owns the parcel and is willing to sell. Painter said at the time staff made assessments, we did a lot of talking, some of it not quite so public for some, but public for others. The city had previously had held a handful of community stakeholder events to get the word out about the new amphitheater, but confusion and concern from some, particularly Heritage Park and Boylan Heights residents, remains. Painter described that convention center, amphitheater, and the new hotel going up alongside them as a three-legged stool that will sustain each other and bring revenue to downtown Raleigh. She said having the expansion brings in more bodies, brings in more business, fills more hotel rooms, helps all boats rise. Connectivity and accessibility are our top priorities in the new plan, Painter said. Site renderings show Lenore Street redesigned to connect to the Chavis Dix Strollway with improved street crossings, a new pocket park on South Dawson Street, and a tree-lined, pedestrian, cyclist-friendly Lenore Street with wide sidewalks. Painter added that timing is also a factor. The city wants that new amphitheater ready in time for the 2026 concert season. Otherwise, touring acts could skip over the venue that year and never return. Painter said that city staff are aware of traffic concerns and are considering the feasibility of adding a connector or slip lane for eastbound vehicular traffic between Dawson and McDowell to reroute traffic that South Street closure will impact. But she emphasized this is not a part of the plan the council will vote on in September, just an idea for the future. Following her presentation, several council members, including Christina Jones, Stormy Forte, Mary Black, and Jane Harrison, said there should have been more public engagement from the start. At Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin's request, City Manager Marshall Adams David agreed to schedule a community engagement event before that planned September the 17th vote by the council. Because of the tight timeline, Adams David said city staff, not the council members, will likely lead that event. Harrison said she also wants to see a traffic impact analysis of South Street before the vote. The general consensus among the councilors seemed to be that more work is needed before September 17th to iron out details, but they want to make it happen. In the end, they voted unanimously to authorize the city manager to execute the instruments necessary to purchase that 0.2-acre parcel for no more than $150,000 and accepted a resolution of intent to close one block of South Street. That's two steps toward advancing the Red Hat relocation, despite some unresolved loose ends. Next, also from Raleigh, well, you may not believe it, but election season's coming up, and the Wake County Democratic Party has released endorsements in nonpartisan local races that will appear on county ballots, including, controversially, for the Raleigh City Council races, in which multiple Democrats are running. The endorsements include a mix of incumbents and newcomers, and the party's 11-member executive council picked some different candidates than it did in the last council election in 2022. The party endorsed Janet Cowell, former council member, state lawmaker, and state treasurer, for mayor. In 22, it had endorsed NC State University professor Terrence Ruth over incumbent Mary Ann Baldwin. And Ruth is running for mayor again this year. The party did not explain why it endorsed which candidates, but it published the candidate responses to a questionnaire it sent out to all on its website. The party also endorsed Mitchell Silver, a former Raleigh City planner, for District A, against incumbent Mary Black, whom it had endorsed in 2022. In District B, they endorsed Megan Patton, the only Democrat in that race. District C, Tulalope Omokaye, was endorsed over the incumbent member, Corey Branch, whom it also did not endorse in 22. District D, Jane Harrison was endorsed. She's running unopposed. In E, the incumbent Christina Jones, whom it endorsed in 22. Stormy Forte and Jonathan Melton got the in-large race endorsements. 2 weeks ago, a group of prominent Raleigh Democrats sent a letter to the party chair, Kevin Creech, and executive director, Wesley Knott, asking them not to make endorsements in local elections in Raleigh this fall. Additionally, members of the local party's Jewish caucus wrote letters asking the party not to endorse over frustrations with council members Mary Black and Christina Jones, who had advocated for a ceasefire resolution in Gaza. Creech explained that the party had been making endorsements, has been, in the local elections since 2011, following a Tea Party takeover of Wake County Public Schools Board of Education. But the party has not always endorsed in every council race. For instance, in 2019, the party only endorsed in the City Council District E race, even though all the other races were also on the ballot. Creech says the decision to not endorse in some races that year came from a change in protocol made at the time by Democratic Party Executive Council. That's a group of 10 elected party officers and one apportioned treasurer must be appointed, that include the chair and executive director. Creech was not a member of the council at that time. In response to the letter that the Raleigh Democrats sent to the party, Solidarity with Humanity, a political action committee dedicated to building power for Palestinians, also sent a letter to executive council members addressing the PAC's concerns and stating its support for Black and Jones. More than 100 local organizers, leaders, and residents signed it. The letter noted that Raleigh's failed ceasefire resolution proposal was written, quote, in collaboration with Raleigh's Jewish and Muslim communities, and seems critical of the Jewish caucus's request to get the party not to endorse Black and Jones. The letter also criticizes selective targeting of Black and Jones, noting that District B Councillor Megan Patton and District D Jane Harrison also supported the ceasefire resolution, though neither have Democratic opponents in their council races this fall. And the letter says smear campaigns that reek of McCarthyism should have no place in the Democratic Party. Mary Black and Christina Jones have demonstrated exemplary service to their constituents and have consistently worked to address the needs of the community. They have consistently shown the courage to both lead and respond to community members, including those whose families experienced displacement and genocide. Mary Thompson, a former member of Wake County Democratic Party Executive Committee, says the party's endorsement process has been, quote, thorough and meticulous for over a decade. It involves hours spent reviewing applications, studying issues, conducting candidate interviews, and engaging in deliberation. She wrote in an email to Indy, what unites us is our shared commitment to electing Democrats who will champion our values and advance our collective goals. We believe that bullying and threats within the party from current or former office holders are harmful and contrary to our values. Well, let's see. Quote, we are disheartened to read the recent piece in the Indy discussing divisions within the Wake County Democratic Party, particularly regarding these endorsements for city council and mayor. It's important to remember that Democratic Party is a big tent, encompassing a wide range of views and opinions. Disagreement on specific issues or endorsements is a natural aspect of this diversity, should be embraced rather than criticized. And that letter goes on for several more paragraphs, but you get the drift, and I'll close that article for right now. Next, Avery Sloan wrote this for the Indy in on the 13th of August. That's about ballot access for third-party candidates. The Libertarian Party is working to meet people where they are, says Matthew Lesage, spelled L-A-S-Z-A-C-S, a Libertarian running for State House in Wake County in a general election this fall. For him, that means keeping taxes low, deregulating health care at local level, and lowering costs and regulations for new businesses. Lesage, excuse me if I say that wrong, and a record number of Libertarian candidates, as well as candidates from various other parties that aren't Republican or Democratic, are on Wake voters' ballots this year. They want to shift voters' thinking, even if winning an election is an unlikely scenario. All of these candidates are vying for North Carolina's unaffiliated voters, who make up the largest voting bloc in North Carolina with 37.5% of registered voters. Democrats make 31.7% and Republicans 29.9%. Libertarians make up 0.7% of registered voters, while 0.04% belong to the Green Party. And Lesage says, "We have reached a point in time where a lot of people are getting very frustrated with the political environment." The intention of running as third-party candidate also goes beyond hoping to win an election. For North Carolina Libertarian Party Vice Chair Sean Hoff and candidates Guy Millier and Mike Ross, their main focus, they say, is getting the word out about their platforms and helping voters think outside of the two-party system. The Libertarian Party has 37 candidates on the November ballot in races across the state. Every voter in Wake County has at least 7 Libertarian candidates on their ballot, and in some precincts up to 10. The plan was to fill the ballot with Libertarian candidates as much as possible, says Hoff, who's running for state agriculture commissioner and worked formerly as a pizza delivery driver in Durham. The Libertarians are united in their desire for parents to have more control over where their children go to school, competitive pay for teachers and more vocational training, and market-based solutions to traffic, such as the use of autonomous vehicles and relaxing transit regulations. Hoff says that's just more opportunities for us to present our ideas and ourselves as a complete political party, better than some kind of cult of ideology or personality. This year, in addition to the Democratic, Republican, Libertarian parties, the Green Party, We the People Party, Constitution Party, and Justice for All Party could all appear on North Carolina voters' ballots. In order to get on the ballot under a new party name, a party needs 13,865 signatures from registered voters and the approval from the North Carolina Board of Elections. But besides the many signatures needed, it can be difficult for parties to get on the ballot, as parties also have to ensure their intent is to elect their specific candidates, not hurt other parties' chances of winning. Earlier this year, the Justice for All Party was blocked from the ballot after it was deemed to have the wrong intent, until a judge reversed that decision this week. And after getting on the ballot, third parties also have not historically been successful in state general elections. No third-party candidate in North Carolina has received more than 4.1% of the popular vote in a contested race since 1992, when Libertarian gubernatorial candidate Scott McLaughlin raked in 105,000 votes. Michael Dublin, a Wake County candidate for U.S. House of Representatives, is running as a Green Party candidate. Dublin grew up in Raleigh as a Democrat, but over time felt that the party let him down. A self-proclaimed foot soldier for justice, Dublin has always been involved with protests for social issues and says, as a black man, the Green Party aligns more with his beliefs, saying, "I was one of those people that joined the masses of people who in North Carolina became unaffiliated." Libertarian candidate Matthew Cordon is running for State House in District 11, and says he has one election goal, receive enough votes to gain his political opponent's attention. He says, I truly believe we don't technically live in a two-party system. This is just a mental trap. Enough people have told themselves, and because of that fact, it's a vicious cycle. We tell ourselves that a third party can't win, and therefore the third party can't win. Last month, the State Board of Elections allowed Robert F. Kennedy's We the People Party to appear on voters' ballots this fall. A judge ruled yesterday against the North Carolina Democratic Party in a lawsuit it brought against the Board of Elections for certifying We the People. As of now, RFK Jr. is the only candidate the party is running. I must say that since this article was printed, we understand that Kennedy himself is going to withdraw from the election and throw his support behind Donald Trump. The Conservative Constitution Party will also have candidates on the ballot. The Constitution Party was recognized in 2018, but in 2021, the Board of Elections decided not to certify it along with the Green Party for failing to meet necessary requirements. This year, the board voted to recognize the party once again after it got needed signature, but the board initially voted to postpone that decision, allowing the party less time to submit its own candidates and prepare. The Constitution Party will run candidates for governor and lieutenant governor. Last month, the Board of Elections voted not to allow Cornell West's Justice for All Party ballot access, citing issues with the group's collection of the citizen signatures required. The board referenced a video in which Donald Trump supporters appear to collect signatures for Justice for All, telling voters it will help take votes away from Joe Biden, who was running for election at the time. But a federal judge reversed that decision Monday in a rebuke to the board. That's not the first time the Board of Elections voted to deny a third party over similar concerns 2 years ago. Ahead of midterm elections, the board initially denied the Green Party ballot recognition during an open investigation into fraud and ballot irregularities. Dublin, one of the three candidates the Green Party is running this year, says he tried to run in 2022, but after the party struggled to get certification, it decided to only run two candidates, and Dublin wasn't one of them. This year, he's looking to make a difference, either in office or with his campaign. My goal is to win, he says. Secondarily, my whole goal is to help grow the Green Party, spread the word, and get more, hopefully, younger people to come into the party. If I don't win, just to get the message out there, there is an alternative. There's another way to do this. Ross, a Libertarian candidate for governor, says he doesn't think the board's past decisions to exclude parties had the people of North Carolina's best interest in mind, saying that's three parties that a partisan board in Raleigh basically disenfranchised and took away all the work of all their volunteers who are out there collecting signatures. That's actually something, in the long run, I hope is going to move politics in the direction of people-first politics, as opposed to the special interest-first politics we have now. Melior, a Libertarian candidate for the House of Representatives, District 4, says in a previous election, the votes he received were more than the difference between Republican and Democratic candidates, but doesn't really think his votes would have changed the outcome. Nor was that why he ran. He said, I would joke to the Democratic candidate who won that I was a spoiler, but I don't know where more votes would come from, so I don't see that as a primary goal. The spoiler effect is a theory that voting for a candidate who is likely to lose can impact the results of an election. It has informed the Board of Elections' decision to allow certain parties on the ballot in the past. A Duke University public policy professor, Asher Hildebrand, says third-party candidates, while not new, can have an impact on a local, state, and national level. Quote, given just how narrow the margins of victory in many cases, including the presidential race, are expected to be this year, that's one reason why the presence of third parties on ballots in states like North Carolina feels like such a high-stakes question. voting for a third party instead of one of the two majors could very well decide the race. Hildebrand says he doesn't think any of the third parties on ballots in the state and around the country are anywhere close to viable as a real option for voters, but they can absolutely play spoiler in the election. No matter the intention, he says, the power of third-party candidates can't be overstated. And while the existence of candidates is not new, the current political climate may be pushing people to consider or vote third party at the federal level. Says many voters today are broadly frustrated with the lack of choice that having only two major parties gives them, and maybe uniquely frustrated with the candidates that the two major parties have nominated for president this year. Bob Drax, Libertarian candidate for state auditor, says despite people in polls saying they're fed up with Democrat or Republican candidates, they still don't, for the most part, end up voting third party. Drax referenced a recent Meredith poll surveying North Carolina residents on voter satisfaction, where 57% of people surveyed feel a third party is needed to improve government. Drax says people are lying. Nobody believes that third-party candidates are going to win. One way to steer voters away from so-called spoiler candidates is to make a change to the voting system itself. Hildebrand says other countries, even some states and municipalities, have used other methods such as ranked choice voting. But this is difficult to accomplish in North Carolina, as there is not a way for citizens to get specific resolutions directly on a ballot, leaving voters reliant on partisan legislators to bring the issue up. Hildebrand says even when there's no supermajority in the legislature, elected officials tend to be averse to changing the system that got them elected. Ranked choice voting was piloted in 2007 in two municipalities, including Cary, but it only lasted for one election cycle, as the voting machines used at the time ultimately could not handle ranked choice voting, meaning ballots had to be hand-counted. Even with these issues in exit poll results, two-thirds of the 1,600 respondents preferred ranked choice voting. Travis Grew, a Libertarian for the State House in Wake County and chair of the Wake Libertarian Party, references this pilot and other states that have done ranked choice voting successfully. Grew says it's a voter's true vote and leads to winners having received a true majority vote. Quote, there's no harm in trying something new because it's not a binary system. Sometimes you have multiple candidates. Sometimes the voters like the third party, maybe as their second choice, and then they can put third choice for the other people. So, I mean, it just works out. So I'm a big fan of it. A ranked choice voting system is one alternative Ross also agrees with and says in a perfect world he would one day like to see an all-write-in ballot. Quote, I feel like everything we have that's bad is because we've had these two parties consistently giving us bad policy from the top down. And I see that it seems more and more disconnected from what regular people want and need. Ross says he doesn't consider himself to be much of a politician, but he ran for office because he was fed up with the politicians in power and their lack of action. This same idea, he hopes, will eventually motivate others to vote third party. Maybe not this election, but someday, he says. Quote, I'm optimistic that if they keep doing these things that are so blatantly partisan, and they keep giving us these banned candidates, that's how third parties will ultimately win. We didn't get to this position overnight. It's going to take more than one election cycle. If that protest vote goes and then starts to merge with an actual growth in that party, that's how you become a real threat. Well, we're over to Durham now, and one of the cover stories in this week's Indie Week is about Leonardo Williams, the Durham's new mayor. Leonardo Leo Williams, stood tall on the stage inside Fletcher Hall at the historic Carolina Theater, preparing to give his first State of the City address as the newly elected mayor of Durham. The sound machine, North Carolina Central's marching band, filled the walkways and flanked the mayor as a large screen cycled through photos of Durham's life. Williams' one-hour-long speech was teeming with spectacle, distinguishing his address from those his predecessors delivered inside of City Hall. He implored the crowd during the April address, "I charge you all to be bold in your vision for this community and seek out opportunities to be involved in the work to make the American dream Durham's reality." Williams, 43, is one of the youngest mayors in the city's history. A former NC Central drum major and Southern High School band director, he knows how to put on a show. While his predecessor, retired Judge Elaine O'Neill, mostly stayed out of the public eye, Williams, a towering 6'4", is easily spotted, bouncing between City Hall meetings, the restaurants he manages with his wife, community events, political rallies, and occasionally shredding on a skateboard in the middle of CCB Plaza. Last fall, Williams captured nearly two-thirds of the vote, running as a charismatic business leader, ready to take on the urgent challenge of putting Durham back on course. His big tent approach to coalition building earned him endorsements across the political spectrum, from the Progressive People's Alliance to the moderate Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People and Friends of Durham, PACs. But actions speak louder than words. 9 months into his tenure, Williams has a tangible record on housing, transit, infrastructure, and the economy. Now his constituents are looking for delivery on his most ambitious promises, revitalizing downtown, improving public safety, and procuring more affordable housing. With pressing issues and a need for detailed policy considerations on the table, can Williams' enthusiasm and egalitarian approach to politics be enough to launch Durham's next era? Williams, like many who plant roots here, came to the Bull City for an education. He grew up with his mom and three younger siblings in rural Halifax County, where farming and other blue-collar industries still dominated the economy. College was one of the few tickets out. Williams' mother, Yolanda Bailey, inspired him to pursue a degree in teaching. She'd served on the board of the North Carolina Teachers Association, the predecessor to what's commonly thought of as the statewide teachers' union, the North Carolina Association of Editors. Excuse me, I sneezed in the middle of that. The North Carolina Association of Educators, NCAE. Bailey taught in Halifax and Nash County School for 44 years, taking her son on work trips to witness community activism firsthand. "She was a leader," recalls Williams. "Everybody about her, they were educators. It was a village, and I was the baby of the conference. I remember it vividly, just being around them." He arrived at NC Central in 1999, where he majored in music education and education psychology and was recruited to join the marching band. Williams met Zweli Moyo on campus during their freshman year. She had come from Zimbabwe to study hospitality and tourism, and the two became fast friends. They bonded over their love for food. Zweli cooked meals packed with spice and flavor that captivated Williams. She says his commitment to service kept him constantly busy. She says, "When I met him, his life revolved around social activities and being actively involved in whatever he was doing, like band or youth camp. He took it so seriously and made it a top priority." But the two went their separate ways after college, to her various Triangle restaurants, and Williams to public education, first as a high school classroom teacher and band director. Williams joined the Durham Association of Educators, the DAE, and served at the board from 2008 to 2010. While he describes himself as a committed Democrat, Williams says he registered as an independent during that time so that Republicans, quote, would pick up my calls. In 2017, the Republican-led General Assembly proposed converting two Durham public schools, Glen Elementary and Lakewood Elementary, into charters through what became known as the Innovative School District, ISD. Williams was working as an education consultant at the time, and his good friend Terrence Ruth, a professor of social work at NC State University and a candidate for mayor in Raleigh, recruited him to the ISD project. Members of the NCAE considered this plan a non-starter, but Williams says someone in Governor Cooper's office told him the cabinet was working with bipartisan members of the General Assembly to pull out the good parts and provide increased flexibility for public school principals. This excited Williams. He says, "That was my whole criticism. Why is it that charter schools and private schools have all the flexibility, but public school administrators don't?" But it soon became clear to Williams that Republicans were using the initiative to orchestrate a takeover of public schools. Williams said he sounded the alarm to the DAE. "This is not what was advertised," says Williams. "This is not some feel-good, try and support principals. This is a takeover." His own reputation as a champion of public schools was on the line. At a community meeting, Williams says NCAE leadership singled out as the architect of the charter school takeover. While he eventually resigned from that project, his involvement burned bridges with some in the education space. Williams says he's managed to rebuild some of those bridges in the years since. Michelle Burton, a former school board member and the president of DAE at the time, "Leo learns from his mistakes. I like that about him." Other developments were also pulling him away from education. A chance encounter with Zweli's sister, Tiny, at the gym had brought them back together more than a decade after graduation. After Tiny reconnected them, Williams wasted little time courting Zweli. He says, "We connected that day for a 5-minute conversation that turned into a 7-hour conversation. I called everybody I was dating at the time and said, 'You know, it's just not going to work. I just met my wife.'" That would do it. The couple married in 2015. Williams became stepfather to her son, Isaiah. Williams convinced his new wife to share her culinary gifts. 3 years later, they opened Zweli's Kitchen, the country's first Zimbabwean restaurant. Zweli's separated itself from other Durham restaurants with its unique cuisine and location in a strip mall out of downtown. When momentum slowed with the COVID pandemic, Williams and others formed the Durham Small Business Coalition to call on the city to do more for business owners in crisis. He says, "I'm like, what are these politicians doing? I was pissed. I cannot see another business close because I know what we want through, what we went through to open ours. I was like, literally, dreams are dying right now, and there's a way of doing it better." Still, the Williamses found ways to make their business work during the shutdown, which led to an invite from the Biden campaign to be special guests at a presidential debate in October of 2020. Williams says meeting Biden that night made him a devout supporter. It also marked a convergence of his two worlds, business and politics. He came into local politics as a relative unknown. Former mayor and the founder of Indy, Steve Shule, convinced Williams to consider local government in 2020 when a seat on the city council opened up that spring after Vernetta Alston departed to join the General Assembly. Williams submitted his application, but the council ultimately appointed Pierce Freeland, a musician and educator from a prominent Durham family, to fill that seat. But the process gave Williams a taste for local governance. The next year, he ran for Ward 3 City Council seat as a voice for small business, but says he only wanted to serve for a short time. "I only ran for council because of what I was going through as a small business owner. I always intended to serve one term, support small businesses, and get out of the way." The DAE endorsed his opponent, community organizer A.J. Williams. Burton says some members still questioned whether he'd look out for public schools. After conversations with Leo Williams, Burton says, she personally felt he had been doing what he ultimately thought was best for students at the time, saying people at their core really want children to have a great education, to grow up and live to their fullest potential. Williams' city council run introduced him to Durham's unique system of political PACs and alliances, and he says, I didn't look at it as political. I looked at it as a service. I had to be navigated through the political process. And he ultimately won by fewer than 1,000 votes. In his first term, Williams came across as a peacekeeper and go-between for the increasingly fractured council, particularly in the waning months of O'Neill's tenure, amidst extortion allegations, a verbal and allegedly physical confrontation between council members, and a growing chasm on housing policy. But the disarray within the council was eroding his patience. Williams says, I wrote a handwritten resignation letter, and one of the custodians actually ripped it up. I was going to submit my letter and then just leave the council because there was so much fighting and arguing. When O'Neill announced she wouldn't seek re-election in 2023, signs pointed to Mark Anthony Middleton, the mayor pro tem, as a natural successor. Williams said, it was a really hard 2 years to sit through. So I was constantly in Middleton's ear saying, you need to run, you need to run. Candidates started to enter the race, but when no sitting council member announced a run, people started looking at Williams. I started hearing, Leo, you just need to run for mayor. I'm like, no, absolutely not. You see how folks are acting on this council? You see how people in the community are acting? You think I have time for that? In July of 2023, State Senator Mike Woodard announced his plans to run for mayor. And in late July, Councilmember Deidreana Freeman announced she would run. With the clock ticking on the filing deadline, Shewell invited Williams over and made a final appeal. Williams announced 2 days later. In a crowded field, Williams separated himself by simply having less baggage than the other two candidates. Freeman's alleged altercation and recent votes had created a schism with some in the city's progressive faction, and political rivals characterized her campaign as a continuation of dysfunctional administration. While Woodard had represented Durham in the state senate for 12 years, and as a council member before that, his willingness to work with Republicans in an increasingly polarized political environment had soured enough folks to dampen his chances. Still, Williams had his own limitations. Rural county residents and environmental advocates were displeased with his votes for development, and solid waste workers and some other city employees held Williams responsible for a 2023 budget that did not include requested raises. Williams presented as cool, calm, and collected, a candidate who was open-minded and pragmatic. That earned him endorsements from a broad spectrum of organizations, including from Durham's most influential PACs, the People's Alliance and the Committee on the Affairs of Black People, a feat that's almost unheard of in Durham politics, and he ended up winning with 63% of the vote. 2 months into Williams' term, a mass of protesters poured into City Hall. Quay Weston, a Durham resident, delivered remarks connecting gentrification and displacement in Durham to displacement in Gaza that set off a 30-minute-long demonstration where protesters sang and left roses at the foot of the dais as police huddled in front of the city council. Weston told the crowd, "We are not only in a housing crisis, but a crisis when it comes to our priorities. As we witness increased housing insecurity and displacement of residents, it must be connected to the displacement of Palestinian people through genocidal actions that are being funded by our tax dollars." On February 19th, Williams was one of two council members to vote against adopting a ceasefire resolution, putting his relationship with Durham's young progressive activists in question. Weston says leaders like Williams, quote, become this brand and this persona, but in their decisions they're often opposed to the work that's happening on the ground with grassroots organizations. The protest led to more stringent administration of rules and procedures in City Hall, limiting the time to speak at public hearings, restricting the number of attendees per building fire code, and keeping remarks from residents and colleagues germane to the topic, all in an effort to cut down on bloated meeting times. Weston and others see this shift in policy as an ambitious, driven show of strength on Williams' part. But restoring order to the city council was one of the keystones of Williams' mayoral campaign. He said one day in July, we had a work session that started at 1 p.m. We got out at 7:30 p.m. Monday night. We started at 7 another night. We got out at 1:30 in the morning. No business owner in their right mind is going to be want a part of that. I'm not in my right mind. He says meeting procedures are likely to get even stricter as the council returns after summer recess. It's just one of the ways Williams conducts the people's business, as former Mayor O'Neill often called it, in stark contrast to his predecessor. He's been an outspoken proponent of growth, and his votes follow suit. Williams and some others on the council say the housing shortage is too substantial for them to say no to new development. But many residents aren't sold. More than any other issue, they come to City Hall to condemn approval of thousands of housing units, much of it in southeast Durham. The tension led to a member of the Planning Commission resigning in early June over what he described as being dismissed, at times ignored, and even denigrated. Brett Stargell, a local political consultant, led a training to recruit and support candidates that Williams attended in 2020. Stargell says Williams' votes on development made sense in the context of a growing city, even as state laws bind leaders when it comes to implementing progressive property taxes and regulating growth. Stargell says, we want to continue to pay our city workers at a level that keeps up with inflation and continue to fund a lot of those programs designed to reduce violence and alleviate poverty. There's already a lot of tension within our budget and questions about sustainability. Despite these differences, Williams says there is little ill will between him and his constituents. We don't hate each other. They may hate my votes, and it may be a little annoying they always come and say the same thing, but I love those folks because I know we share a passion for this community. My strategy in communication is being accessible, honest, and transparent. We should be able to talk about anything. Williams is certainly a Democrat of the more moderate variety, and his voting pattern doesn't easily track along Durham's more left-leaning politics. In addition to that no vote on the ceasefire, Williams backed extending the city's use of the shot spotter technology, votes that alienated Durham's progressives, many of whom had campaigned for Williams and endorsed him. Former city council member Jillian Johnson says, to some degree, that's not unexpected. Quote, I don't think the majority of people vote based on a consistent political ideology or a coherent political strategy. Elections tend to be more about personality and familiarity. And so there's this interesting paradox. The skills that are required to win an election are not the same skills that are required to be a good elected official. For Williams, the skills that propelled him to the mayor's office are what make up his governing philosophy. Everyone is invited into the tent. He used the ceasefire vote as an example, explaining that while he is personally in favor of a ceasefire resolution, he voted against one because he wanted the record to reflect that the city's residents were divided on the topic. My first priority is to lead the city, he says. I wanted to vote for the ceasefire, but I didn't, because I needed that vote to be broken to represent the voice of this community, which was also broken. It was split. But what you cannot deny is everybody had a voice. While this big tent style has lost Williams a few fans, it has also led to compromises and significant policy victories. In June, the council unanimously passed the 24-25 budget without much blowback. City Councilor Nate Baker says, "I don't think this budget reflects the budget that any individual up here would have created. But I do think it does a phenomenal job of taking a lot of complicated views up here and creating one single document that reflects the values of all of us." Durham is governed by a council manager, or a weak mayoral system. The mayor has no more voting power than anyone else on the council. But residents tend to think you're either an expert in everything and can fix all their problems, or you're clueless and can't be trusted. There's almost no middle ground. Balancing these expectations separates the job of mayor from that of the city council counterparts, says Steve Shule. Quote, "Even though you're the first among equals in terms of voting, you still have a lot of stuff that comes to you that not everyone gets, whether it be all the appointments you've got to make or just because you're mayor and people know it. My email traffic tripled when I was mayor. There's just a lot of external demands." In essence, the mayor serves as the city's chief marketing officer, and Williams has grabbed that title by the horns. Every day he's out and about, trying to get more residents to buy into his plans, which include big capital projects like a new convention center and affordable living, making housing, transport, and other essential needs more accessible. Nicole Thompson, president and CEO of the nonprofit advocacy group Downtown Durham Incorporated, says he is showing up in a variety of different places and carrying a message. He's not just in one place. He's going where the community is. Nor is Williams bound by the city limits. He's the first in line to welcome state and federal officials to the Triangle and rarely misses an opportunity to travel outside the state. In June, he rolled out the red carpet for President Biden when he landed at RDU after that disastrous debate, facilitating a spontaneous dance party on the tarmac in the early hours of the morning. The day Biden announced he was stepping down as the Democratic nominee, Williams was co-hosting an event with U.S. Representative Ro Khanna at Ponysaurus. This commitment is not only for the photo ops. It has arguably paid off with additional funding for consequential projects in Durham, including millions of dollars for transit and infrastructure. Still, what some might see as promoting Durham, others interpret as being self-interested or leveraging his position for his own gain. When gubernatorial candidate Josh Stein hosted an event at Zwilly's Kitchen in May, Williams made an appearance before leaving to preside over a council meeting. Even an innocuous fundraising initiative selling Durham is Dope t-shirts to raise money for a youth mentoring program rubbed some the wrong way. While Williams has said he has no intention to seek higher office, his routine references to his friends in Washington give the impression that Durham might not be his final destination. But with running two restaurants and Isaiah starting freshman year at Duke, Williams will continue to call the Bull City home as he has since the siren song of NC Central Marching Band first pulled him in 2 decades ago. At his State of the City address, Williams said his leadership would focus on, quote, "fostering an environment inside City Hall and the community at large that encourages innovation and out-of-the-box thinking." Still, the challenges, revitalizing downtown post-pandemic, addressing the housing shortage, tackling the scourge of gun violence remain, and there is no easy way to solve them in Durham or elsewhere. He will need to build alliances and partnerships if his grand vision is going to come to life. For now, Williams is the sometimes unruly city's ringmaster. He knows how to put on a show, but there's still the question of corralling people into his tent. Now, I'm regrettably short in time now to read further complete articles, and I'll just give one more about a book release by Adrienne Marie Brown, Loving Connections. That was published by AK Press on August the 20th, and this will be very abridged. When the author and activist Adrienne Marie Brown moved to Durham during the pandemic, one of the first things she did was befriend a tree in her backyard. The ritual, suggested by a friend, helped Brown ground herself in the new space. She says, "Anytime people give me flowers, after a couple days, I go lay the flowers out around the tree, adorn the tree. I put some bird feeders up so that everyone knew to come visit." She was on a recent Zoom call from her bright office. "It's become quite a sweet little ecosystem back there over the time I've been here. Every time I do any ritual inside, there's a part of it that gets brought outside and left at the tree." That practice, making the internal work you're doing on and for yourself flow into the way you relate to the rest of the world, is central to Brown's latest book, Loving Connections. It's a collection of 20 essays and a few closing spells. It's an encouragement that working on yourself, specifically with an openness to being connected, is an important part of fighting for collective change. Brown has spent the last 2 days facilitating, organizing, and movement work, and that career is central to her writing work. She's edited and written 7 essay collections prior to this one, including 2019's Pleasure Activism, which was a New York Times bestseller. She's also written 2 science fiction novels, etc., etc. Brown also facilitates movement meetings all across the country. "Different organizations," she said, "would ask me to come and hold the space, hold the room, hold the meeting, set the agenda." Well, that article is so interesting, I hadn't read enough of it. I'm going to put it in my folder, and hopefully John Feddersen can read it to you in its entirety next week on my next presentation for The Independent. And for the North Carolina Reading Service, I am John Feddersen, as I've already stated. And we'll return next week with the Indie Week broadcast. Thanks for listening, everybody.